as we go from 600,000 lower, every year, every drop increases the complexity and the problems compound.
A throughput study predicts trouble for taps. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 29th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a research team looks for contamination on Amchitka.
Being a young man, a young boy at St. George Island when this happened, and grandfather and my uncle, they were very scared and fearful.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Governor Sean Parnell today finalized the state's operating and capital projects budgets. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The governor approved using $11.4 billion, 6.9 of it in state money. But that's after cutting $403 million from capital expenses the legislature wanted to make, bringing the entire spending for the session within limits he's comfortable in approving. He said the operating budget was limited to a 2.9% growth, and no operating elements were vetoed.
Much of the operating budget growth is driven by statutory formulas. The budget, this budget that we're releasing right now, fully funds those legal obligations, including mandated increase to the kindergarten through 12th grade formula, Medicaid formula costs, retirement system costs, including the state's unfunded pension liability. It addresses our debt service costs and employee contracts.
The $2.8 billion capital budget was heavy on energy projects. The plan adds $400 million to the Power Cost Equalization Fund, more than $110 million for hydro projects. He also allowed $36 million for renewable energy grants, more than $100 million for weatherization and home rebates, and $12 million for a geothermal project at Mount Spur. He did refuse to give the entire $18 million the legislature wanted for the Mount Spur project, and he did veto $10 million for the Homer natural gas pipeline. The capital budget had drawn concern at the end of the session when Governor Parnell threatened using his veto power as a retribution against members who did not support his oil tax proposal. That comment alone led to the first special legislative session this year, as the Senate refused to pass a bill until the governor assured members that veto decisions would be based on the merits of the projects. For example, Bethel, home of Senate Finance Co-Chair Lyman Hoffman, sustained more than $30 million in project cuts. But Parnell says there was no retaliation there, and that shows up in the regional balance in the budget. He says Bethel did very well overall.
They wound up with more per capita than any other district, as I understand it. So the cuts to that district, I believe, still leave them with the highest per capita spending in the state. What that district has in this budget that's very important to them includes a new school in Kaskiak. It includes the pre-maternal home in Bethel. It includes Quinnahawk School, I believe, is in that district as well. So there are some major projects in that district.
In Bethel, the governor did veto $3.5 million toward an administrative building for the Association of Village Council Presidents, and he vetoed $2.5 million for a campus water and sewer line. The governor said the purpose of the vetoes, $700 million in the past 2 years, is to prepare to pay off for the unfunded pension liability that will one day become due. It's $11 billion right now. He said it will also prepare the state if the economy begins to sink. Right now, the governor says the state has $15 billion in savings. And he says the legislature can get more freedom in spending it if the executive and legislative branches agree on spending limits at the start of the sessions. However, he said, they would not get complete freedom. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Although some areas in the state may be bemoaning budget losses. The cuts were not unexpected. Governor Parnell cited declining oil production as one reason for the cuts, and that decline is spurring inclusion in the budget of money aimed at upgrading infrastructure friendly to oil development. One of those projects affects Anaktuvuk Pass. The budget includes $8 million for a road to Umiat that will affect the remote community. The road will provide access to mining leases. Anaktuvuk Pass Mayor Esther Hugo has been outspoken in opposing the road. Despite Parnell's stated objective to fill up taps with millions of gallons of crude a day, REAP, or Renewable Energy Alaska Project Director Chris Rose, says he's pleased with the inclusion in the budget of funds aimed at renewable energy projects.
Well, we're very happy that the governor spared almost all the renewable energy and energy efficiency money that the legislature appropriated this year. The legislature appropriated over $100 million for energy efficiency programs like the weatherization and rebate programs, and just a little bit of that got cut. There's still over $100 million for that. The Renewable Energy Grant Fund also was fully funded this year. The Alaska Energy Authority had requested a little over $36 million for more than 70 projects around the state, and the governor left that completely alone.
Doug Griffin, city manager in Palmer, was also pleased with Governor Parnell's budget decisions. He says the Matanuska Valley City avoided all vetoes.
We had five items that were in the capital budget. Our biggest project that survived and was funded was $400,000 to match local money that's going toward expanding our ice arena. Then we had a series of other projects involving assisting the city in acquiring the Matanuska-made property. That's the property around the iconic water tower for the city of Palmer. So we did very well.
Griffin says a few Palmer requests for funding did not even make it into the original budget. Federal leasing officials are again asking Alaskans to provide feedback on a document that looks at the possible impacts of offshore oil drilling in the Chukchi Sea. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, or BOEMER, will hold a public meeting in Anchorage tonight as part of a statewide tour of seven communities. KBRW's Jake Neer has more.
BOEMER released the revised draft supplemental environmental impact statement for lease sale 193 in the Chukchi Sea to respond to a lawsuit filed by native and environmental groups over the sale. They charged the original EIS from 2008 left out a number of possible impacts of the leasing plan. The court agreed and added that BOEMER had also failed to address the possible impacts of natural gas development on the lease areas. BOEMER's regional director for Alaska, James Kendall, said the revised supplemental EIS now includes that information, but he says officials from within the agency also saw something missing from the document.
Because of what happened in the Gulf of Mexico, the deepwater oil spill, we felt that we should look at a very large oil spill for the Arctic. Now, this is purely a hypothetical situation where we looked at the entire region and what were to happen if there was a well placed in the quote-unquote perfect location for a major blowout with all of the resource being expended with no controls.
That section on a possible very large oil spill sparked much of the testimony at BOEMER's public meeting in Barrow Monday night. The Inupiat Community of the Arctic Slope, or ICAS, is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit over lease sale 193. ICAS Councilman George Edwardson says the risk of such an oil spill outweighs any reward when subsistence hunting might be affected.
It's not oil that's going to feed us. It might make us travel faster a little bit longer, but it's not going to keep us alive.
Natural Resources Director for ICAS, Kion Opie, gave the organization's official response to the revised document. She says they're pleased with the inclusion of a very large oil spill scenario, but still are not pleased with the depth of analysis.
This analysis shows the very far-reaching and devastating impacts of a spill in the Chukchi, but does not answer our questions. Are the oil and gas companies capable of cleaning up a spill in the Arctic waters with ice, hurricane force winds, darkness, and other challenging conditions? Should they be allowed to explore if they have not shown that they are capable of a cleanup?
OPI says ICAS officials are concerned about response time to a possible spill, with the closest Coast Guard office over 1,000 miles away, and whether industry and or the government will act and how if subsistence resources are not available for villages that can't afford to live off store-bought foods. Bomer Regional Director James Kendall says it's too early to address many of those issues at this stage.
All of those questions are very good, but they come into different aspects of the four phases. And right now we're looking at making a decision just for the leasing. A lot of the more specifics we will address if and when we get an exploration plan. And then if it moves to the point of development, and we actually have a proposal before it to put pipelines in, then we would know where they would come ashore, what infrastructure is needed, what assets are available to clean up a potential spill, what's been moved into the area, what the oil company says they have, and what we can actually go and see, etc.
Once Bomer is done collecting public comments on the revised draft supplemental EIS on July 11th, they'll finalize the document and then send it to the Secretary of Interior for a final decision whether or not to affirm the lease sale by October 3rd. At that point, the courts will decide if the missing information was addressed appropriately. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage School Superintendent prepares to say goodbye to the district.
This is my 37th year in the district, and so this is kind of like my family. So I am emotional.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The FAA Alaskan region has taken many steps to improve commercial aviation travel in Alaska, including new runways and navigational aids. The FAA urges you to be a partner in this circle of safety to help prevent aviation accidents. Please pay attention to the pilot during the passenger briefing. Understand weather delays or cancellations. Don't ask the pilot to fly lower than is safe and legal, and carry emergency supplies. As informed passengers, we can have an influence on making flying in Alaska safe. This announcement is sponsored by the Federal Aviation Administration.
A study released today lays out new details on an old problem: declining oil throughput in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company conducted the study to learn more about how the pipeline will operate if the amount of oil continues to decline in the years ahead. Right now, about 600,000 barrels are flowing through the pipeline each day. Alyeska Communications Director Michelle Egan says when that amount drops below 550,000 barrels a day, the company will have to take measures to keep the oil warmer.
There become problems with water dropping out, wax building up in the pipe, and at very low levels, potential frost heaves that could damage the pipe.
Alyeska is already testing different types of insulation it might use to prevent the oil from getting too cold. Another heating tactic the company pioneered during a shutdown last winter was running the oil back through each pump station. Egan says this study looked at mitigation measures that could work as long as the oil flow was above 350,000 barrels per day. She says below that level, things get more challenging.
As we go from 600,000 lower, every year, every drop increases the complexity and the problems compound. And when you get to 350,000, it would take very extensive measures and it needs a lot more study.
Alyeska says it will take about 10 years to reach that level at the current rate of decline. Egan says the best solution is to add more oil to the pipeline. She says the mitigation measures to keep the oil moving at low flow rates will cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Environmental groups say that's a small figure compared to the hundreds of billions of dollars worth of oil that's still in the ground on the North Slope. Subsistence users on the Kuskokwim River are facing a new series of unprecedented restrictions. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is calling for the first-of-its-kind net restriction on the Kuskokwim. The poor king run there is also exposing divisions between state and federal fisheries managers. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
Along the Kuskokwim, people are getting used to new and unexpected fishing restrictions this summer. But this week came with a big one. An emergency order from Fish and Game will restrict subsistence users on the Kuskokwim to mesh sizes of 6 inches or smaller. None of the 8 or 7 inch gear that's so effective at targeting king salmon will be allowed in the Western Alaska River. The decision was made after looking at king salmon numbers at the Bethel test fishery during a record-long 5-day closure. Biologist Chuck Brazil put a positive spin on some disappointing numbers.
Definitely better than 2010, which was our worst year on record.
But better than the worst year is giving biologists no confidence that enough kings will make it to their spawning grounds. Fish and Game says the restriction to 6-inch mesh wouldn't eliminate the king harvest, but it would curtail it with the chum salmon run at its peak right now.
Yes, you're still going to catch Chinook salmon, but now that densities of sockeye and chum are higher, you're likely to put more of those fish in your net other than just Chinook salmon as well.
Any gear that complies with the emergency order will likely pick up a lot of reds and chums. Fish and Game hopes that alone will limit the amount of kings anyone can even attempt to harvest. The working group agreed. By a unanimous vote, they supported Fish and Game's proposal. While local users were in unison, fish managers were not. The state proposed just mesh restrictions, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to go further. They proposed another fishing closure. When the working group refused to consider it, they called for it by special order anyway. The closure of federal waters will be the biggest geographic closure on the Kuskokwim River on record. Rather than just calling for a lower river closure like the state, the federal closure will run hundreds of miles to the village of Aniak. Acting Director of the Yukon Delta Wildlife Refuge, Tom Doolittle.
6-inch mesh is not a 100% mesh size to protect Chinook. We really just thought that the 6-inch regulation of that the state is invoking and that the working group supported was not conservative enough to really to accommodate the real hard biological concerns in these lower rivers.
This closure is sure to be controversial. Working group member and co-chair Beverly Hoffman of Bethel has been one of the most vocal proponents of conservation measures, but she said another closure would just be too much.
We've had a 4-day closure. We've had a 5-day closure. My concern is if we have further restrictions that prevent people from getting that last bit of fish on their rack, that's a hardship too when they've already had 9 days of closures.
According to a survey by Bethel's tribe, the Okhotsk-Hukamut Native Council, the majority of families in the Bethel area are satisfied with their catches so far, with some already done fishing, but many others were planning to finish up this week. Above Bethel, there's still plenty of rack space to fill. Time is running out too. Fish and Game says on average, 70 to 80% of the Kuskokwim King Run has passed through the Bethel area on a typical year. But Doolittle says some pretty important fish still have some swimming to complete.
What we see this time of year is that many times we have a higher proportion of females. We know in that first plug of fish we had earlier on that we had a ton of males get upriver. And now it's time for the ladies to get up there. And many of these fish are quite large. And these large fish produce a lot of eggs.
Doolittle says many of those large, fertile females are headed to the lower Kuskokwim tributaries, which are the rivers where escapement has been falling short for the last 3 to 4 years. The 3-day federal closure will run through Saturday. After that, fishers will be restricted to smaller gear, unless new restrictions are put in place. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
A research team is on the western Aleutian island of Amchitka looking for residual contamination from a 20th century military legacy that culminated in 3 underground nuclear tests. KUCB's Jacob Resnick reports.
Amchitka was the site of 3 underground nuclear tests: Longshot in 1965, Milroe in 1969, and Kanakin in 1971, which at nearly 5 megatons is the largest known underground test by the United States. Today, the site is part of the Arctic Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, and the sites of these tests are being monitored by the Department of Energy's Office of Legacy Management. Earlier this month, a 16-person team arrived on the island to take samples. Project manager Mark Kautsky is leading the team.
We're looking to see if there's any movement of radionuclides into the food chain, into the web, food web. And so we'll be sampling from the bottom of the ocean where groundwater may be discharging into the ocean. We're also sampling on the ground surface on the island itself.
Opposition to the original nuclear tests culminated in the founding of Greenpeace in the early 1970s. The group's oceans campaigner in Alaska is George Stepnikov. He grew up in the Pribilofs and was just coming of age when the Atomic Energy Commission and Department of Defense was using Amchitka as a Cold War testing ground.
From being a young man, a young boy on St. George Island when this happened, and watching and listening to the conversations of my parents as well as my grandfather and my uncles, they were very scared and fearful.
In 1996, Greenpeace sponsored its own expedition to Amchitka. The group claimed that past government studies had been inadequate in detecting slow-decaying radioactive isotopes. It conducted its own research that claimed it had detected radiation was leaking. But 10 years later, a team that included the University of Alaska Fairbanks scientists studied algae in the region. It found that detectable levels of radiation around Amchitka to be similar to neighboring islands, which hadn't been the site of underground tests. Kautsky says research he's seen shows no evidence of leaks.
No detectable tritium in any of the waters, either off the island or on the island. And the radionuclide concentrations in the seafood and the food chain were below detection level.
The results from the summer's test won't be published for 6 to 9 months, but Kautsky says they will be publicly released. While Pletnikov doesn't dispute the scientist's claims, he says he's not ready to jump to conclusions that the nuclear legacy isn't doing harm.
So far, the waste has been contained and is not leaking to the degree that will excite the people of the world to wonder why we did what we did, what can we do to mediate that. But we don't know the amount that could or may be leaking and how that impacts the ecosystem as a whole.
And after visiting Amchitka himself in 2007, he says he feels the tests were no less than a crime against nature and the native peoples. Even though researchers say they've found inconsequential traces of radioactivity, the island remains off limits to any drilling near the test sites. And Kautsky says the sampling work is projected to continue for generations.
The length of our testing is such that we want to protect human health and environment. And because radionuclides have different half-lives and they may be persistent in the environment, we want to make sure that the length of our monitoring program spans the duration of natural decay of radioactivity on the site.
Given the slow rate of decay of the radioactive material, he says that means at least another 75 years. In Unalaska, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Anchorage School District Superintendent Carol Como announced yesterday she is retiring in 1 year. Como made the announcement flanked by school board members and district staff, as KSKA's Len Anderson reports. While there were some comments about the replacement process, Como spent most of the time offering reflections and observations on an educational career spanning well over three decades.
Carol Como's relationship with the Anchorage School District began in 1974. While awaiting to renew her certification, allowing her to teach in Alaska, she took a job as a noon duty attendant and teacher's aide at Ocean View Elementary. The next year, she became a teacher at the school and began a series of positions that 10 years ago led to the superintendent's office.
I have loved this job. I care deeply about the Anchorage School District.
Como, who is 69, said the separation from the district would not necessarily be easy, but the time had come for a new focus.
This is my 37th year in the district, and so this is kind of like my family. So I am emotional, but I'm really actually looking forward to the next chapter after a year. Being a grandmother and kind of really reconnecting with my family.
Como said it had become increasingly difficult to balance being superintendent and a grandmother.
What I found this year especially has been that having to schedule visits to visit family, all of whom live outside, is always around school board schedule and assembly meetings and the legislative session. And So as we've gotten older, my husband and I have just decided, you know, we want to travel a little bit and want to have some family time.
Only Como and her husband of 48 years, Dennis, live in Alaska. Their children and grandchildren are divided between Washington State and Georgia. School Board President Gretchen Guess said Como's 12-month notice gives the board an advantage in its search for a successor.
This is going to allow the school board to have a very thoughtful process. We'll be starting that immediately, and we will announce the process going forward when we have resolved that and communicate that clearly to the public.
Besides Noon Monitor, teacher, and superintendent, Como has also served the district as a principal at three schools, an executive director of elementary schools, and an assistant superintendent of instruction. She says she's enjoyed all her district positions, but there were favorite memories.
Well, I loved my teaching career. I had a great 11 years at Ocean View in Spring Hill and 1 year in Oregon right out of college. So I'd really loved teaching. I thoroughly enjoyed my time as an elementary principal. There's nothing quite like it when you're having a bad day. You just go down to the kindergarten class and they love everybody. And the school-based positions, no question, those are where you get the best rewards because you're around students. And I went into education because I hope to make a difference for kids. So, and I think I am.
At her retirement announcement, Como paused to reflect beyond the school district to the community as a whole.
Investing in the public education system in Anchorage is one of the most important investments they can make if they really want to bring businesses in to the community to grow the economy.
After her official announcement, Como was talking to some reporters. Asked what her family's reaction was, she said, when she got to her office after telling the board, she had a late-night text message from one of her sons asking, "Did you really do it?" "I really did it," she sent back. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jake Neer in Barrow, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Jacob Resnick in Unalaska, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. North Rim Bank, taking your business to the next level. With help from North Rim Bank, spot the turns and opportunities that lie ahead for Alaska. More at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.